The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Alok Jha. This week on the show, the UK reels from weeks of bad weather, floods and storms. I'll be joined by The Guardian's head of environment, Damien Carrington, to discuss why this country is so badly affected and seemingly so ill-prepared.
Again, interestingly, if you hit someone with a blunt instrument, the first blow doesn't cause blood splashing. A lot of people think it does, it doesn't.
I meet Mike Silverman, one of the UK's leading forensic scientists, to discuss the state of modern crime scene investigation. Also, we'll be looking at some of this week's science stories, including the extraordinary complexity of your gut bacteria and why Marius the giraffe had to die. It was for science, apparently. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. To kick things off, we've got The Guardian's head of environment, Damien Carrington. To discuss, Damien, what no doubt has been a very busy few weeks for you, we're going to talk about the floods. Tell us in a nutshell what's been happening.
In a nutshell, it's Stormageddon. So what's happened since the middle of December or start of December is there's just been this completely unprecedented conveyor belt of bad weather coming off the Atlantic. And individually, any one of those wasn't so extraordinary, but it's just the length of time it's continued over. And we've had everything. We've had, you know, gigantic storm surges, the worst since 53 on the East Coast in December. We've had the wettest January since records began in 1766, so at least 250 years. We're on for having one of the windiest periods on record as well, which obviously we've experienced in the last few days. And that's delivered an extraordinary amount of water, which has, that deluge has inundated many parts of southern England and parts of Wales as well.
Now, weather breaking records in the UK is almost not a news story sometimes, but these have been some horrendous things and affecting the lives of thousands and thousands of people. Whereabouts in the country is worst affected, and what's the sort of prognosis?
Well, it's hit pretty much everywhere across southern England, so right down from Cornwall and Devon, where they've had the storm surges to deal with, as well as high winds and some flooding, all the way over to Kent, which was flooded around Christmas time, and then up into the Midlands, Worcester doing not so well at the moment on the Severn, Aberystwyth, for example, in Wales, got hit really hard with some storm surges. So it's been really widespread, but kind of across the Midlands, southern England and Wales.
And do we know why?
Do we know why?
Why have all these storms come all at once?
Well, in a sense, there's two answers, right? So there's the meteorological one, which is rather complicated. It actually starts off in the Pacific with some warmer weather there, and that somehow knocks through in this complex climate system that we have to the very cold weather they've had in North America. And then that knocks through again through different mechanisms into the Atlantic. And one of the reasons is that the jet stream, which normally would guide a lot of those storms over the north of Scotland, so we wouldn't see them further south in the country. That jet stream's further to the south, so it's kind of channeling all that bad weather right across the most populated parts of the UK. And although no one can tell for sure at the moment, it may be that the melting of the Arctic ice has something to do with the jet stream moving. I mean, the other way of answering it is about extreme weather, and from a climate change point of view, there's just basic physics tells you that warmer air carries more water, and therefore you're more likely to get big downpours. Also, a warmer world means the sea is warmer, so it's expanding, as well as the ice melting. So sea level's risen about 12 centimetres in the last century, I think, in the UK, and that gives a head start to a storm surge if it's trying to get over a sea defence, as it did at Dawlish, for example, where it knocked out the main railway line.
And warmer temperatures in the sea, of course, mean stronger storms as well, because there's more energy for the storm to actually do its thing.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I don't know about the kind of storms. Certainly that's true for tropical storms, hurricanes and typhoons. I'm not quite sure about this. I mean, one thing that people have been arguing a lot about the link potentially between climate change and extreme weather. There's a really interesting study which people haven't picked up on so widely, which was done by Miles Allen at Oxford, which looked at floods way back in 2000 in southern England. And what they showed there by a massive computing effort was that those floods 14 years ago were made twice as likely by climate change. So when people say you can't link the two, you can in terms of how the dice has been loaded. But they can only do that for very particular events because it's very computationally intense. But certainly, as I say, from the basic physics point of view, we'd certainly expect more extreme weather.
Yeah, you'd expect more extreme weather. And the mantra has always been from scientists is that you'd expect more extreme weather, but you can't link specific storms, specific instances anywhere in the world to climate change. But, you know, what's your feeling on this? Is this a climate change induced effect? We're going to see more of these things, I'm assuming, these sorts of events.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, as I say, this study I referred to earlier by Miles Allen at Oxford, it's called attribution, whereby you work out what the odds, how stacked the odds were for a particular event. And they've done it for heat waves, for example. In 2003, there was a big heat wave in Europe, and in 2010, there was a big one in Russia. Again, those were doubled or trebled in likelihood by climate change. So when you look at the details there, you can certainly see that there's a direct link. In terms of looking at kind of weather records, you're looking at extreme events. Extreme events, by definition, are rare. So you need a very long time to get the kind of robust stats to look at significance there. I mean, climate scientists usually, they don't want to talk about climate over less than three decades. And of course, the records don't go back for some things as far as that.
Now, you might see, if you're sort of an observer of this, you might think that England and Scotland, everyone, wherever it's been affecting people, the authorities weren't prepared, and perhaps that if flood defences were better, the situation wouldn't have been so bad. How true is that? I mean, could we have prepared for this?
Yes, is the short answer. The thing to notice is that more than 1.3 million properties in England and Wales were protected by flood defences. So down in places like Banbury and Newbury and places like that, which were affected by flooding in very recent years, they haven't flooded this time, despite this extraordinary deluge. So flood defences certainly work, and plenty of people have been protected, but of course 6,000 people have their homes flooded. That's revolting, disgusting, traumatic. Hundreds of thousands of people have lost power at different times. Travel has been chaotic. And certainly, you know, it's been a big political row, as you'd expect. And the reality is that when the current government entered office, it cut flood defence spending by about £100 million on an annual basis, and that's continued. So it's self-evident that if those cuts hadn't been made, there would have been better protection for more people around the country.
Although David Cameron now says that he'll spend any money you like on making the situation better.
Well, that money no object claim is certainly one that may come back to haunt him. He's made it fairly clear that money's no object in the relief effort, but he's been much less clear about whether it would involve investing in future defences.
And what do we learn from all this for future policy? The one thing, of course, which we've known for a long time is about building on floodplains and planning permissions and as you say, defending places against floods. What do you learn from all this for the next 10 years and expecting more of this sort of stuff to happen, by the way?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a number of things come out of it. One is that spending money on flood defences is fantastic value for money. You save £8 in the long run for every pound that you spend. So it's an incredible false economy. And the government's official advisers, the Climate Change Committee, say that the cuts or the hole in the government's flood defence spending will probably end up costing us about £3 billion. On a completely different level, home level protection. I've spoken to lots of people about this over the last few weeks, and certainly they would encourage people to take some responsibility for themselves rather than thinking, you know, someone's going to build me a flood defence over there, I'm going to be fine. I mean, of course they'd expect that to some degree, but on the other hand, there's actually quite a lot you can do, and certainly people who live in flood prone areas are familiar with that. But because the floods are becoming more common and will affect more people, people should take action, you know, in their own homes, including kind of strange things like toilet bungs, which is basically a rubber ball you put down the toilet and pump up so that it blocks the toilet and stops that sewage surging up into your house, which of course is extremely unpleasant.
Damien, thank you very, very much indeed. Let's get back to actually doing some reporting on the floods now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll get some more updates soon.
Thank you.
Now, to keep up to date with all the flooding news, go to theguardian.com/environment. Joining me now in the studio to discuss this week's science news is Emily Grossman and Observer Tech Monthly's commissioning editor and writer Nicola Davis. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Emily, we're going to start with you. You're actually going to talk about a piece in Observer Tech Monthly about, well, Well, do you tell me what it's about? It's about poo, isn't it?
It is about poo. Can't really dress it up any other way. It's about Andrew Anthony, who sent his stool sample, which we would call poo, off to a lab in Cork in Ireland to have it sequenced. And what that means is he was looking at the bacterial levels in his poo and finding out what that meant about his diet. So they sequenced the bacteria, they sequenced everything in his poo, 95% of which was actually bacterial genes. And they, the group led by Paul O'Toole in Cork were able to then tell him what kind of diet he had been eating and whether or not that was particularly healthy, because the diversity of the gut bacteria reflects what our diet is. Now, the reason I find this so interesting is because there's this exploding new research field on what's called the microbiome, which is the makeup of all of the microorganisms in and around our body. And that actually makes up about 100 trillion cells. That's outnumbering our own cells by 3 to 1. And the diversity of our microbiome reflects not only what we eat, but also potentially our susceptibility to certain diseases.
Now, this is, even though you're talking about things exploding in guts, that's always a bit dodgy as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, let's move beyond that in a sort of non-puerile fashion. And just give me a sense of what can you do with this information if you sequence someone's gut bacteria? What can you do with it right now?
So right now, the sequence that was sent to these guys in Cork was used to reflect not only what Andrew had eaten, but also how healthy he was as a result of that. So what they're suggesting is that these tests could become routine. About a year ago, they cost £400 to do a stool test. Now it's only £15, and obviously it's going to get cheaper, and it could become a routine test, just like testing your cholesterol, to see what your health parameters are because of your diet. And to extend on that, there's several groups all over the world. I spoke to Professor Dusho Ehrlich, who runs a group in France, and he was telling me that together with a Danish group, they've found that 1 in 4 people have a low diversity of their gut bacteria. And these same 1 in 4 people are at higher risk of developing diseases associated with obesity, so like heart disease and liver disease and diabetes. So what's really exciting is that in the future, they're looking at developing a scan, or a cheap scan that could be available to everybody, to analyse the diversity of people's gut microbiome, the bacteria that are present in their gut, to see whether they are likely to develop these diseases associated with obesity, and then to give them treatments or diets which can bring down that risk before these people actually develop the disease.
Now, this is all exciting. I think that it's sort of helped along by the gene sequencing technology becoming cheaper and everything. But my question I've always had about this stuff is, what does it tell you that you can't already tell by just recording your diet or looking at the stuff in your blood and things that we already know in medicine? This seems quite sophisticated to tell you that you're eating too much meat, so for example, which you probably know already.
Well, the fact is people do know it already, but they're ignoring it. They might know it on a kind of subconscious level, but psychologically, people don't do anything about it unless they're given an actual fact, an actual piece of data from their doctors to say, you are in the 1 in 4 people who is at risk currently of developing X disease.
Nicola, you want to come in?
Yeah, I have a question. So this is obviously fascinating, and the piece was extremely interesting, nothing like
sending... If you say so yourself.
If I say so myself. I know it was an Observer Tech Monthly, but, you know, not that I'm biased at all. But no, my question is that we know that there's a correlation between eating a lot of fatty food and putting on weight, but that's, you know, something we've all learned from, you know...
Eating burgers.
From me, speak for yourself there, Alok. But... in terms of the correlation here, so is it that you lack certain bacteria in your gut and that gives rise to a greater risk? Or is it that you are at greater risk and as a result of that, you will have less
right.
respect? Which way around does that
Absolutely.
Correlation go?
So
cause and effect, how
exactly,
does that work?
Exactly, chicken and the egg.
Yeah.
Is it a causal link? And
that's
the exact piece of information that is still not totally 100% clear. But that brings on to a kind of interesting experiment that I was reading about in the Netherlands, where they actually transplanted fecal implants, which is basically putting poo from one person into another person. And they found that in patients with diabetes, if they gave them implants of the higher more diverse bacteria from healthy patients, they actually saw an alleviation of the disease in these diabetic patients.
And would that have to be a process you had to have repeated frequently?
I didn't go into that much
detail. Ask that with a straight face.
Fecal transplants aren't as disgusting as you actually think.
They're not.
I spoke to a scientist who sort of does these things, not on as a regular basis or for fun or anything, but the example he gave me was, for example, if you have a lack of diversity, or if your gut microbes are overtaken by a particular type of bacteria, for example, which then cause problems, C. difficile, for example, or something like that, you've got a big infection, then the only way to get rid of that infection essentially is to flush all of your bacteria out, all of them, essentially hardcore antibiotics to get rid of it all. And then you need to repopulate with a very diverse set of bacteria. And what you do is you take someone's poo, of course, you clean it, which you think, well, once you clean poo, what's left? Well, bacteria is left. You just got a colony of bacteria. You put it into a yogurt drink of some sort, and you drink it. And why is that disgusting? It is what it is. And then you don't have a horrible C. difficile infection anymore. And these things kill people in hospitals on a regular basis. So it's actually a very interesting way of treating. And actually, the idea of treating your microbes, for me, what's most interesting about this is that when you eat food, you're not just eating food for yourself. You're eating food that encourages good or bad bacteria, so to speak, inverted commas, to grow. And you can make sure that by eating various things, the different bacteria grow in preferential amounts and then do their good things for you. And actually, those things will have other impacts on your health. They've been linked to mood. They've been linked to things like brain function and things. Even glimmers of evidence about autism and things. Really, really interesting research. Nicola, talk to me about giraffes.
Well, yes. So this week we've had the fate of Marius, the giraffe that's in Denmark, or was in Denmark, in Copenhagen, being put down, for want of a better expression, even though he was young, fit, healthy, frolicking, no doubt, around the zoo. Unfortunately, he met a rather sad end. And this has been sort of a hot topic this week.
I've missed this story. Not being a zoo-y sort of person, but what happened? What did this frolicking giraffe? What turned up at the zoo somehow and was killed? What happened?
So essentially, he was shot and dissected and thrown to the lions. Now that sounds pretty nasty. But
are you serious?
Yes. In front of people. Let's go back to why this happened in the first place.
Maybe you should have started with that.
Marius wasn't a nasty giraffe. Marius wasn't ill or sick. The problem with Marius was that he didn't really serve a purpose.
Well, he's a giraffe.
He's a giraffe. He's not going to write a sonnet or compose a sonata. But Marius wasn't particularly inbred. But the problem was that he wouldn't have been allowed to breed. They wouldn't have been allowed to breed from him at the zoo because there was a risk that he could have... he was too genetically close to other giraffes in the zoo, so they couldn't breed from him because it might result in harmful genetic traits being developed within the giraffe population. So they couldn't breed from him. They couldn't really move him to another zoo because there wasn't a sort of suitable place for him. He was either too genetically close to giraffes in other zoos, or there wasn't the right circumstances. So the thing is, you can't have lots of male and female giraffes just milling around.
Because they'll try and
have
sex with each other.
Well, the thing is that male giraffes altogether, it seems, are all right. But you can only have one male amongst a female population, otherwise they will start fighting. So there wasn't really a suitable setup that Marius could move into. He wasn't old enough to be used really as a bull.
And they couldn't, and they didn't have a space for him by himself somewhere.
We're not talking about housing a hamster
loft
here.
Somewhere.
We're talking, this isn't, a stray dog. I mean, this is an enormous animal that needs a lot of
care.
Okay,
so there was a serious scientific conservation reason had to die.
But it has upset rather a lot of people.
Yeah, I imagine.
Because it wasn't obvious, really sort of from the outside why this had to happen. But I think the point that I think is important from this is that we need to not look at zoos as being sort of just a nice little home for some rather odd creatures that we won't see down the high street. You know, they're not there just to be stared at.
How many creatures do you see down the high street?
I mean, generally speaking, you wouldn't see a giraffe.
But, you certainly wouldn't.
This is not just there for us to point and stare and go, oh gosh, look, it's a giraffe. You know, zoos are involved in conservation programs, and you know, making sure that genetic diversity is maintained is really important. And unfortunately, sometimes that means that a giraffe cops it.
I still don't know why you wouldn't have just chucked Marius out into the wild, or given him or built a home for him, maybe, or raised money.
It's expensive.
Yeah, I imagine it is expensive. But I mean,
and in the meantime, you've got to
crowdfunding. There's the amount of people who are pissed off about it. They could have stuck hands in their pockets.
They could have started a Kickstarter program, Alok, but unfortunately, that really wasn't an option. And I think the other thing that people were slightly horrified about was the fact that they filmed Marius being skinned and chopped up and
thrown. Yeah, why did they do that?
Because I do think that this is actually quite admirable in some ways. It was to show, you know, the public sort of
what it's like to kill an animal.
Well, no, it's about the fact that this is what would happen in the wild. This is what would happen. A giraffe, it could be a young giraffe, it could be an old giraffe, whatever. Dies and it gets eaten by other animals. It doesn't just get neatly, forensically swept away and disposed of.
This is harsh lessons for kids. Emily?
I mean, I totally agree that there are circumstances in which Marius couldn't have been kept in that zoo, certainly within that enclosure, the inbreeding, the fighting, absolutely. But there's a lot of talk out there that zoos have a responsibility to look after animals that they bring into the world. And yes, it would have been expensive to build him his own pen, but there were zoos around the world. There was one in Yorkshire who was actually offering to take Marius on and to look after him. And the fact was, there was a petition of 27,000 names or more who were actually saying, please, can we keep Marius alive? And I understand the circumstance. I understand that it's important that they're not allowed to breed, but surely there are other ways.
So the thing is, the Yorkshire Wildlife Park, which offered to take it, Marius's brother was there already, and Marius's genetic makeup would not have brought a huge amount of diversity to that park either. So it might just be a case of moving the problem. And there's only a certain amount of space for giraffes in any one park. They're not, you know, they're big animals, they require a lot of care. It's not easy. And it might have been, as they said, that, you know, a genetically more viable giraffe might actually have been better to be moved there than Marius.
Do we know what Marius's brother was called?
No idea. I'm afraid.
Darius? No.
Who knows?
Sorry,
and the other thing is that this idea of bringing animals into the world, so this idea of giraffe contraception, bit tricky. There are contraceptives out there, but it is difficult. It's not as advanced as human contraceptives. It's not as simple as that. Also, the point about having giraffes in zoos, again, they're not just there to point and stare. You want to try to allow them. This is going to sound a bit trite, but to try to allow a vaguely natural circle of life there. They're not, you know, hermetically sealed specimens. They should be allowed to mate. It would be even more unnatural in some ways to stop them from mating. That's what they are, you know.
Good. No, you're making a good case. You're making a good
case.
So
I think that the other thing here is that a giraffe looks pretty. We love giraffes because they look so big and elegant, beautiful and a bit awkward. Lovely. If this was a, I don't know, rattlesnake, would we be having this argument? I don't know. You know,
a rattlesnake. Put it in a bag and take it to another zoo quite easily.
Pretty animals, you know, and us feeling that's...
I think it's a case of whether, if the public is really campaigning for something, whether a zoo has the right to effectively play God in that way.
Well, the zoo has to pay for the giraffe and look after the giraffe, not the public.
Sure, but when the zoos themselves, they really struggle because in terms of PR, it looks really bad for the zoos to be doing this. And zoos struggle as it is. There's a lot of mixed feelings about zoos. And when it was such a hugely recognised issue, and it comes at a time when a similar thing happened at Longleat Zoo with the Pride of Lions, where they killed, effectively, a Pride of Lions. And I'm not saying that wasn't the right thing to do biologically, and that, yes, it happens in the wild, but there are other options that could have been investigated, and it just seems a shame. And we need public support for zoos, and we need financial support and people to go to zoos for education, to learn about endangered species, and to look after endangered species.
But we also need zoos to do good science. Good science can't be at the mercy of PR campaigns.
Yeah, that's true. But I tell you what, this has taught a lot of people about, as you say, the in nature red and tooth and claw thing of this creature. Some of these creatures would have been eaten by lions on various savannas and things, and so it is like it's a harsh lesson.
It is a harsh lesson. To be said. It is a harsh lesson.
And I think that Nicola, perhaps your Danish heritage is making you a bit more defensive of these Danes.
You know, I love giraffes as much as the next person.
Nicola, Emily, thank you both very much indeed. If you want to read more about any of these stories, you can go to theguardian.com/science. And Nicola, tell us when the next Observer Tech Monthly is going to be out.
The next Observer Tech Monthly is out on the 9th of March.
Emily, where can we see you next?
Well, I'm currently on a panel of science experts on Sky One's new panel show called Duck Quacks Don't Echo, which is hosted by Lee Mack and is showing every Friday night at 10 o'clock on
Fantastic.
Sky One.
Do duck quacks echo?
Well, actually, they do. But that's the point of the show, is that some of the science facts are totally true, some of them not so, and some of them not at all.
And the idea is what? To distinguish between the lot?
The idea is for a panel of celebrities to vie it out between them to see who's got the most watertight science fact.
Fantastic. All right, we'll look forward to that. Forensic science is one of those things that, a bit like space and dinosaurs, is properly exciting for those of us on the outside. From Waking the Dead to Dexter and the CSI franchise, the drama of forensic investigations has become central to our entertainment culture. Meanwhile, the science itself has been advancing over the decades, and is capable now of some remarkable things. Mike Silverman is one of the UK's foremost forensic scientists, and he's just written a book about his career called Written in Blood. He joins me now to discuss a life dedicated to this hugely important branch of science. Welcome, Mike. Can you just describe your career for me? You've been in forensic science for more than 30 years. Just give me a picture of how different forensic science was when you started to the modern stuff that may be misrepresented in CSI, but at least it gives you a flavour.
It's completely different. When I started, with the exception of fingerprints, which wasn't really the world of the forensic scientist, it was the fingerprint expert. We didn't do fingerprints, we did everything else. When I started, forensic science was entirely corroborative. The police had to have a suspect, they had to send samples in from that person, and we did the best we could to use science to compare that person with either a victim or a crime scene, to try and put two people in contact. There's a phrase called Lockhart's principle of interchange, which still applies today, whereby it's stated that every contact leaves a trace, so something will be left. And that's the case, and the forensic scientist's job was to find that. With the advent of DNA being used in police work, 1988, Sir Alec Jeffries came up with this method of looking at DNA, which lent itself to investigative work, and then the creation of a DNA database. That's then moved forensic science forward from being a corroborative tool for the police to be an investigative tool. So they could actually then send samples into the lab and get back a name. And that just changed the whole nature of the game.
What are the other techniques that have really changed things? DNA fingerprinting, I think everybody knows about, and is probably ascribed, people think that can solve anything, and in fact it's a very complex procedure actually to sort of match people. But I mean, DNA fingerprinting is one example, but what are the other sort of examples of techniques that have come along in the last few decades which have really changed the way the policing is done?
Well, generically, I mean, the use of computers has obviously been a great one. The introduction of computerized databases, introduced after the Yorkshire Ripper, has made data collection and comparisons much, much better. I mean, that's made a huge difference. The use of at-scene techniques. So it's not so much new science because, as you said, DNA sort of is the silver bullet. I mean, if you can find it, you can analyze it nowadays. So putting a person at a scene from physical evidence is almost wrapped up. The important thing is getting it quickly and analyzing it so that in real time, within minutes of finding it, you're getting a name out. Because it's been shown time and time again that when it comes to actually solving crimes, being able to get onto the suspect very quickly, you're going to find them. You know, if it's 6 months later, they'll have left the country or people will have forgotten who they've seen as witnesses. So the speed of getting a result is really important. So a lot of effort is now put into that. And of course, computer crime didn't exist when I started. That's a major thing. Mobile phone analysis, hard drive analysis is really big now. So those things have changed enormously.
So you go through computer hard drives or phone records, for example, to put things into, put people in scenes or in communication with each other, essentially, in that way.
Yes, as you know, I mean, everything is retained. I mean, nothing is ever, you can't delete a hard drive by pressing delete. It's always in there somewhere, short of actually removing it and smashing it with a hammer or burning it, yeah. It's going to be there. And a lot of the technique is about recovery of these kind of things.
Another technique that I read about in your book, which sort of intrigues me and which I hope you can explain to me, is blood spatter analysis. Now, what can you tell about the sort of position of blood in a crime scene?
Well, I'd like to say anything. You can. I mean, the whole point of me going to a crime scene...
Sounds gruesome. Can I just say that?
It's just another body fluid. But, you know, it's... The reason I used to go to a lot of crime scenes was to look at the blood analysis, to analyse the blood that's splashing around. What's interesting about blood for me anyway is it's so counterintuitive. You know, if I showed you, I'm sure, a blood splash, unless you already knew the answer, and said, has that hit the wall from left to right or right to left? The majority of people get it wrong. It's actually quite odd. I used to lecture at Brams Hill, which was the police training college, and I'd have all of, and these were senior police officers with experience, and I'd test them all, and some would say left to right, some would say right to left. And when I insisted they all had the same answer, they invariably got it wrong. It's actually counterintuitive. So you can tell from a splash of blood its trajectory, where it's come from. If you've got more than one splash, you can construct a three-dimensional image. I used knicker elastic, which was what I brought to forensic science, I think, as a technique.
That's your contribution.
That's my contribution. It was string before me, but string goes saggy. And you can see this on Dexter, if I can quote television programs. He does string reconstructions. Not as good as mine, obviously, but they were there.
What are string
reconstructions?
Right,
what you
they?
Do with a string reconstruction is you can work out the trajectory of a blood splash by measuring its width and its length and taking the sign of, that gives you the sign of the angle of incidence. You can then measure that with a protractor, stick a bit of knicker elastic on the splash, and then follow it back across the room, and then stick it to the other side of the room or to a post or something. And if you do that with a number of splashes, they will cross at the point of impact, the point of origin of the impact. So that we call that string reconstruction. You can do that, so you can find a point of impact. But you can also find from blood splashes how many blows were struck. Again, interestingly, if you hit someone with a blunt instrument, the first blow doesn't cause blood splashing. A lot of people think it does. It doesn't. What it does is break the skin. The blood then wells up, say, in the head, and then the second blow will impact into that blood, and then there'll be an impact spatter. The third blow, the item, whether it's a cricket bat or something, will have blood on it. So in swinging that back to make the third blow, blood will flick off, and you get a track, which is called a weapon track. So one weapon track means three blows, and every additional weapon tracks another blow. So you can tell then the relationship of where the assailant was standing, how many blows were taken. I'd like to say you could tell if they were left or right-handed, but I've never been able to. And although sometimes people stand up in court and say three blows of the left hand, and you'll see this on television a lot, it could just be the person standing a foot to the right and using their right hand. You can't really tell. I couldn't.
So what's interesting about this, of course, is that when you talk about it, it makes a lot of sense. How did this technique develop? Because it's messy. Do you have to sort of strike bags of blood with instruments to sort of test out where the trajectories go? Or is it just a case of 1,000 case histories and you record everything? I mean, how do you catalogue something like this?
Well, I mean, normal fluid dynamics and mathematics will tell you some of it. For instance, as I say, the sign of the angle of incidence. But no, you have to beat up a lot of pig's heads. Pig's heads were good. What we used to do sometimes is reconstruct the crime scene in plywood and then try and reproduce the blood splashing using football soaked in blood or, you know, pig's head. What's tricky, of course, is getting the blood. You can't use red ink. It just doesn't have the same properties.
I'm assuming you can't use real blood either.
Well, yes, we did.
Oh, you did?
We use human blood, and the reason we use human blood is because we used to get it as from the blood bank, when it's out of date. So we weren't taking it from somebody who needed blood transfusion, but out-of-date human blood has all the properties you need, and it works. And the nice thing about using human blood from a blood bank is it's already been screened for infectious diseases. So we knew fairly well that we'd probably be okay. You still need to wear a respirator.
You said right at the start of this that the splatter of blood on a wall is counterintuitive. Why is that? Why would I not be able to tell as a non-expert which way this blood splattered?
Well, it's not that it you couldn't tell. It's easy enough to tell. But what tends to happen is you get a teardrop shape with an oval at one end and narrowing at the other end. And the tendency is for people to think that like a comet, the blood is moving in the direction from the fat end to the thin end, if you like. So where it hits the wall, the fat end is at the front and the thin end is at the back. It's just, I don't know why, but that's the psychology of it. And in fact, it's the other way around. And it's quite obvious if you think about it, because what happens is the spherical blood stain or blood droplet hits the wall, and as it's absorbed onto the substrate, there's less and less blood, so it gets narrower. So in fact, the blood splash points the direction it's going. So the narrow end is the way it's going. It's not a big deal, and they're all the same. Once you know, it's very straightforward. But just for someone who doesn't know, there's a tendency to think it's the other way.
Now, how accurate are these techniques? You just talked about testing the blood splatter, for example. DNA is robust, but there must be a margin of error attached to that, because you've only got a certain amount of references in the database. And so give me a sense of the limitations of these magical-sounding techniques.
Oh, they're magical. There's no two ways about it. I mean, you can get... Let me go back to the early days. The early days, we used to analyse blood by a whole series of techniques, from normal serological ABO grouping through various electrophoretic grouping, phosphoglucomutase. There were dozens of them, literally.
What does that all mean? What you're looking at
are proteins and enzymes that are present in the blood that show polymorphisms. So not everyone has blood, but not everyone is blood group A. So your ABO group is polymorphic. You can be A or B or AB or O. Similarly, there are enzymes in the blood, and they don't make any difference to the functioning, but they're different. So phosphoglucomutase, an enzyme required in the blood, comes in 10 different flavours, if you like. They all do the same thing, but you can distinguish between them using fairly basic electrophoretic techniques. But to do that, you need quite a lot of blood. And also, it goes off fairly quickly. As you know, enzymes will break down if there's heat around or due to activity of bacteria and things. So with degraded samples, often you couldn't get very many blood groups, as we used to call them, to work. So the frequency of a blood stain, individualizing someone from a blood stain, may only be 1 in 50 or 1 in 100 of the population. DNA, apart from identical twins, is uniquely individual. So if you use the right technique, everybody will have individual DNA. So you can individualize someone down to a single person. One of the problems with early DNA as well as blood grouping is degraded samples didn't work. With the introduction of polymerase chain reaction, PCR, which was a technique that was introduced which amplifies small fragments of DNA, we got around that entirely. So you can get DNA results now from PCR from dinosaur blood. It is that robust. And you can get it from amounts of not only blood, but other body fluids and material and skin cells, which you can't even see. So it ticks all the boxes as far as being able to find the stuff in minute quantities and analysing it. Unfortunately, with all these things, there's a human element. So the science may be beautiful, and I use that term advisedly. It really is very nice. Samples get transcribed sometimes. There's a human element where you're putting things onto a database, and sometimes names get confused or the sample might get confused. The danger with DNA, of course, is always contamination. Because you can get a DNA result from, almost molecules, it doesn't take much contamination before you're getting erroneous DNA in amongst the sample, even that of the scientist. So there have been cases where the operational scientist's DNA has come up in a crime stain. And that's where I think the mistakes come. And also, because the technique moves on, the scientist has got a larger choice of techniques. So with a new technique was new a few years ago, low template DNA, whether you use it or you don't use it, is a sort of scientific choice. Sometimes it's the wrong thing to do. So it's not the science. The science is great, but there are choices and there are human elements which can cause problems.
How big a part of a modern crime case, or anything else actually now, do these sort of very cutting edge forensic techniques play? I mean, you talk about some examples of the cases you've worked on. Would some cases just never have come to court or attention without forensics? And I wonder if you can give me a sense of how big a part of a case is the science element, and how complicated that is to explain to juries and so on.
Well, it's interesting because when I started working in Kent, DNA had only just really recently come in, and while I was there, a strategic decision was made that for burglaries, for instance, a scenes of crime officer, CSI, would go out to a crime scene and would only look for DNA-rich evidence or fingerprints. In the earlier days, they'd look for paint and glass and fibres and shoe marks and tool marks, all sorts of things that traditionally forensic science would look at. But because of the fact this now costs money and time is money, and it was much more efficient as far as the cost was concerned to have a scenes of crime officer spending less time at a crime stain, a scene, and go on to the next scene in a burglary, for instance. And we did it in Kent. We focused on fingerprints and blood or body fluids, something you could find DNA on. And that was it, move on to the next one. Obviously different in a murder case or a terrorist offence or something much larger. And the forensic science does play a huge part in it, absolutely huge part, because it's going to give them a name if they get it right. And in a lot of police forces now, I know, they will go for the forensic science first and then look at traditional investigation techniques afterwards. So house-to-house investigations, trace, identify and eliminate suspects, speaking to witnesses, all takes a lot of police time and effort. If you can get a result in a short time from a blood stain and find it to be someone who shouldn't have been there, that solves a lot of time and effort. So it plays a big part.
How do you feel about that as a forensic scientist, though? Because obviously that changes policing. And you, in one sense, you can argue that's a good thing, that it narrows down the options. But also, if you start down the wrong track initially, you then wouldn't have done the other things that maybe you've got that net out there. Well, how do you feel about that?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you focus purely on forensic science and it doesn't deliver, you're then quite some time later in doing the traditional ways of doing things. You know, having said that, there are hundreds of cases, cold cases, which have basically led to nothing, which have been solved purely by revisiting the case evidence with new techniques like DNA. Hundreds of cases that have been solved. And the whole concept of cold case review has really come on since DNA. Similarly, there are people who've spent quite some time in prison who've been exonerated as a result and have been let out. So it does actually work both ways.
Can you give me an example of maybe a cold case that depended on some forensic evidence?
Well, I mean, the ones that I've mentioned in my book, things like Rachel Nickell. I mean, that was quite an old case by the time it was resolved. And that was due to revisiting the evidence again with techniques. In that case, it wasn't a new technique. It was actually, bizarrely, an old technique that worked.
Before we carry on, can you just describe what the Rachel Nickell case was for people who might not know?
It was Rachel Nickell was raped and murdered in southeast London as if you like one of the final parts of a long series of rapes with increasing violence, which was known at the time as the Green Chain rapes because they all occurred near the Green Chain Walk in southeast London. The suspect, the police had actually identified someone they thought had done it and who was exonerated by the DNA. In fact, the investigation had also exonerated him. And it was quite some time later that they found that the DNA that was present, that they hadn't identified or been able to analyse, when they did analyse it, turned out to be someone who was already in prison for a similar offence some time earlier. So it was years later that it was solved. Had it been solved at the time, then clearly further offences wouldn't have occurred.
Now, a lot of this, these techniques that you've talked about depend on people collecting databases of information from which you can compare DNA samples or whatever else, obviously raises questions about liberty and civil liberties, for example. The DNA database, for example, in the UK, there's arguments around how long the police should be able to store this information. Now, I can see there's an argument that if everyone's data was stored, that the police's job would be quite easy, but then they could also do phishing exercises and things. What are your thoughts as a scientist on this? It's obviously useful, but do you sort of lose sleep at night about how much people know about us and are storing about us?
I don't lose sleep overnight, but I am concerned, yes. I mean, the thing with the UK DNA database, which was the first and the largest, which was unusual and hasn't been replicated elsewhere in Europe or America, was that it kept people on it. Once you were arrested and a sample was taken, a mouth swab was taken, it was put on the database. Even if the case wasn't continued, or you were found not guilty, or you were found guilty, or they decided you were no longer a suspect, that mouth swab, that DNA, remained on the database. There actually wasn't a way of taking it off. The software just didn't, you know, wasn't designed to do that. There was obviously lots of questions about human rights, and in fact, obviously, the European Court of Human Rights eventually ruled that we couldn't do that, and we've had to since then start taking people off. Other countries never put them on in the first place. Interestingly, when I did some work in Lithuania, we were asking them at the time, because the UK had a database where everyone was on, and we were there to help them develop a database, we were asking them if they wanted to do that. And they said, you know, to have everybody on. And they said, oh, no, absolutely not. We've just escaped from a regime where that's what they would do, and we wouldn't want to do it. So no one else was following.
There's a huge cultural element to it, isn't there?
There is.
I mean, scientifically, it makes a lot of sense. But
of course, yes.
Now, let's end on a slightly lighter note. Forensic science has never been more popular in entertainment culture, at least, with so many films and programs and things. And the sort of abilities of forensic science seem to be supernatural in a way in these things.
Absolutely.
And I just wonder two things. One, do you enjoy watching those sorts of things and try and guess what's happening? How realistic are those things, really? CSI and the Sherlock Holmes and all those sorts of things.
Oh, you've spoken about two almost polar ends to this thing.
Tell me.
I've tried to watch CSI, and for writing the book, I did watch the first episode, and I had to switch it off after half an hour. I just couldn't cope with it. I was writing copious notes as to why it was so wrong. You know, for instance, let me just tell you, the very first episode of CSI, which goes back years, before even the titles had come up, the main protagonist goes into a crime scene. Okay, he puts gloves on, which is good, but nothing else, no sort of oversuits or anything. Finds that there's a body in the bath, and he picks a maggot off this body, holds it up to the light and says, third instar, this man's been dead 7 days. Well, I happen to know, and I was told by a famous pathologist, a forensic pathologist, that the most accurate way of identifying the time of death is when the victim was last seen alive, and when the body was found, it's somewhere between those two. And you can't really get it that much narrower than that. And I've done a lot of work with maggots, and you know, you've got to know the temperature, the body temperature, the ambient temperature. There wasn't a thermometer in sight on CSI, and it was like, yep, 7 days. And you sort of think, wow, if only that were true. And it went on from there. And after a while, I just said, you know, this just isn't.
You can't,
I don't
disconnect
recognize
from
it.
Just the sort of the.
Oh no, don't get me wrong. The entertainment value is great. I mean, I've even watched Dexter, and that's just like, you know, blood distribution. You don't get in real life people like me, forensic scientists, getting called into a scene and then investigating it. We get called in, we're expected to do our job, maybe buy the chief officer a pint, and then get back to the lab and start doing some work. You know, it's not quite as glamorous as that. Nobody wore high heels and lipstick.
Mike, thank you very, very much indeed.
You're very welcome.
Written in Blood is published by Transworld and out now in all good bookshops, including The Guardian's online bookshop. We'll have links to that on the blog for this podcast. A huge thanks to my guests today, Mike Silverman, Emily Grossman and Nicola Davis. Remember, for the finest science news day or night, go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and producer Jason Phipps, we'll be back next Monday. Thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.